A picture focused itself in Rincewind's memory. It was of a happy, smiling little man with huge spectacles and a trusting, innocent approach to life, which brought terror and destruction everywhere he wandered. Twoflower had been quite unable to believe that the world was a bad place, and that was largely because to him it wasn't. It saved it all up for Rincewind. Rincewind's life had been quite uneventful before he'd met Twoflower. Since then, as far as he could remember, it had contained events in huge amounts. And the little man had gone back home, hadn't he? To Bespelagic, the Empire's only proper seaport. Surely no one would be so gullible as to write this sort of thing. Surely no one apart from one person would be so gullible. Rincewind was not politically minded, but there were some things he could work out not because they were to do with politics, but because they had a lot to do with human nature. Nasty images moved into place like bad scenery. The Empire had a wall around it. If you lived in the Empire, then you learned how to make soup out of pig squeals and swallow spit, because that's how it was done. And you were bullied by soldiers all the time, because that was how the world worked. But if someone wrote a cheerful little book about what I did on my holidays, in a place where the world worked quite differently, then, however fossilized the society, there would always be some people who asked themselves dangerous questions, like, where's the pork? Rincewind stared glumly at the wall. Peasants of the Empire rebel. You have nothing to lose but your heads and hands and feet, and there's this thing they do with a wire waistcoat and a cheese grater. He turned the book over. There was no author's name. There was simply a little message. Increased luck, make copies, extended duration and happiness to the endeavour. Ankh Morpork had had the occasional rebellion too over the years, but no one went around organising things. They just grabbed themselves a weapon and took to the streets. No one bothered with a formal battle cry, relying instead on the well-tried, there he goes, get him, got him, now kick him in a fork. The point was, whatever caused that sort of thing wasn't usually the reason for it. When Mad Lord Snapecase had been hung up by his figgin, according to the history books. However, in common with every other young student, Rincewind had hopefully looked up figgin in the dictionary and found it was a small bun with currants in it. This meant that either the language had changed a little over the years, or that there really was some horrifying aspect to suspending a man alongside a tea cake. It hadn't really been because he'd made poor old Spooner Boggis eat his own nose. It had been because years of inventive nastiness had piled on one another until the grievances reached. There was a terrible scream from the far side of the room. Rincewind was half out of his seat before he noticed the little stage and the actors. A trio of musicians had squatted down on the floor. The inn's customers turned to watch. It was in a way quite enjoyable. Rincewind didn't quite follow the plot, but it went something like man gets girl, man loses girl to other man cuts couple in half, man falls on own sword, all come up front for a bow to what might be the Agatean equivalent of happy days are here again. It was a little hard to make out the fine detail because the actors shouted hoorah a lot and spent much of their time talking to the audience, and their masks all looked the same to Rincewind. The musicians were in a world of their own, or by the sound of it, three different worlds.
Fortune cookie?
Huh? Rincewind re-emerged from the thickets of thespianism to see the landlord beside him. A dish of vaguely bivalvular biscuits was thrust under his nose.
Fortune cookie?
Rincewind reached out. Just as his fingers were about to close on one, the plate was jerked sideways an inch or two, bringing another under his hand. Oh well, he took it. The thing was, his thoughts resumed as the play screamed on. At least in Ankh Morpork you could lay your hands on real weapons. Poor devils. It took more than well-turned slogans and a lot of enthusiasm to run a good rebellion. You needed well-trained fighters and above all a good leader. He hoped they had found one when he was well away. He unrolled the fortune and read it idly, oblivious to the landlord walking around behind him. Instead of the usual, you have just enjoyed an inferior meal, it was quite a complicated pictogram. Rincewind's fingers traced the brush strokes. Many, many apologies. What kind? The musician with the cymbals clashed them together sharply. The wooden cosh bounced off Rincewind's head. The old men playing Shibo nodded happily to themselves and turned back to their game. It was a fine morning. The hideout echoed to the sounds of the Silver Horde getting up, groaning, adjusting various homemade surgical supports, complaining that they couldn't find their spectacles, and mistakenly gumming one another's dentures. Cohen sat with his feet in a bath of warm water, enjoying the sunshine.
"Teach?"
The former geography teacher concentrated on a map he was making.
"Yes, Genghis?"
"What's Mad Hamish going on about?"
"He says the bread's stale, and he can't find his teeth."
"Tell him if things go right for us, he can have a dozen young women just to chew his bread for him," said Cohen.
"That is not very hygienic, Genghis," said Mr. Savaloy, without bothering to look up. "Remember, I explained about hygiene."
Cohen didn't bother to answer. He was thinking. Six old men. And you can't really count Teach. He's a thinker, not a fighter. Self-doubt was not something regularly entertained within the Cohen cranium. When you're trying to carry a struggling temple maiden and a sack of looted temple goods in one hand and fight off half a dozen angry priests with the other, there is little time for reflection. Natural selection saw to it that the professional heroes who at a crucial moment tended to ask themselves questions like, "What is my purpose in life?" very quickly lacked both. But six old men. And the Empire had almost a million men under arms. When you looked at the odds in the cold light of dawn, or even this rather pleasant warm light of dawn, they made you stop and do the arithmetic of death. If the plan went wrong... Cohen bit his lip thoughtfully. If the plan went wrong, it'd take weeks to kill all of them. Maybe he should have let old Thog the Butcher come along too, even though he had to stop fighting every 10 minutes to go to the lavatory. Oh well. He was committed now, so he might as well make the best of it. Cohen's father had taken him to a mountaintop when he was no more than a lad and explained to him the hero's creed and told him that there was no greater joy than to die in battle. Cohen had seen the flaw in this straight away, and a lifetime's experience had reinforced his belief that in fact a greater joy was to kill the other bugger in battle and end up sitting on a heap of gold higher than your horse. It was an observation that had served him well. He stood up and stretched in the sunshine.
"It's a lovely morning, lads," he said. "I feel like $1 million, don't you?"
There was a murmur of reluctant agreement.
"Good," said Cohen. "Let's go and get some."
The Great Wall completely surrounds the Agatian Empire. The word is completely. It is usually about 20 feet high and sheer on its inner side. It is built along beaches and across howling deserts and even on the lip of sheer cliffs where the possibility of attack from outside is remote. On subject islands like Bang Bang Duk and Tingling, there are similar walls, all metaphorically the same wall, and that seems strange to those of an unthinking military disposition who do not realise what its function really is. It's more than just a wall. It is a marker. On one side is the Empire, which in the Agatean language is a word identical with universe. On the other side is nothing. After all, the universe is everything there is. Oh, there may appear to be things like sea, islands, other continents and so on. They may even appear solid. It may be possible to conquer them, walk on them. But they are not ultimately real. The Agatean word for foreigner is the same as the word for ghost, and only one brushstroke away from the word for victim. The walls are sheer in order to discourage those boring people who persist in believing that there might be anything interesting on the other side. Amazingly enough, there are people who simply won't take the hint, even after thousands of years. The ones near the coast build rafts and head out across lonely seas to lands that are a fable. The ones inland resort to man-carrying kites and chairs propelled by fireworks. Many of them die in the attempt, of course. Most of the others are soon caught and made to live in interesting times. But some did make it to the great melting pot called Ankh-Morpork. They arrived with no money. Sailors charged what the market would bear, which was everything. But they had a mad gleam in their eye, and they opened shops and restaurants and worked 24 hours a day. People called this the Ankh-Morpork dream of making piles of cash in a place where your death was unlikely to be a matter of public policy. And it was dreamed all the stronger by people who didn't sleep. Rincewind sometimes thought that his life was punctuated by awakenings. They were not always rude ones. Sometimes they were merely impolite. A very few, one or two perhaps, had been quite nice, especially on the island. The sun had come up in its humdrum fashion, the waves had washed on the beach in quite a boring way, and on several occasions he'd managed to erupt from unconsciousness without his habitual small scream. This one wasn't just rude, it was downright insolent. He was being bumped about, and someone had tied his hands together. It was dark, a fact occasioned by the sack over his head. Rincewind did some calculation and reached a conclusion. "This is the 17th worst day of my life so far," he thought. Being knocked unconscious in pubs was quite commonplace. If it happened in Ankh-Morpork, then you'd likely as not wake up lying on the Ankh with all your money gone, or if a ship was due out on a long and unpopular voyage, chained up in some scupper somewhere with no option for the next 2 years but to plough the ocean wave. A dismal prospect, especially when the horses keep sinking. But generally, the knocker wanted to keep you alive. The Thieves' Guild were punctilious about that. As they said, hit a man too hard and you can only rob him once. Hit him just hard enough and you can rob him every week. If he was in what felt like a cart, then someone had some purpose in keeping him alive. He wished he hadn't thought of that. Someone pulled the sack off. A terrifying visage stared down at him. "I would like to eat your foot," said Rincewind.
"Don't worry, I'm a friend."
The mask was lifted away. There was a young woman behind it, round-faced, snub-nosed, and quite different from any other citizen Rincewind had met hitherto. That was, he realised, because she was looking straight at him. Her clothes, if not her face, had last been seen on the stage.
"Don't cry out," she said.
"Why? What are you going to do?"
"We would have welcomed you properly, but there was no time."
She sat down among the bundles in the back of the swaying cart and regarded him critically.
"Four Big Sandals said you arrived on a dragon and slaughtered a regiment of soldiers," she said.
"I did?"
"And then you worked a magic on a venerable old man and he became a great fighter."
"He did?"
"And you gave him whole meat, even though Four Big Sandals is only of the Pung class."
"I did?"
"And you have your hat."
"Yes, yes, got my hat."
"And yet," said the girl, "you don't look like a great wizard."
"Ah, well, the fact is..."
The girl looked as fragile as a flower. But she'd just pulled out, from somewhere in the folds of her costume, a small but perfectly serviceable knife. Rincewind had picked up an instinct for this sort of thing. This was probably not the time to deny great wizardry.
"The fact is," he repeated, "that... how do I know I can trust you?"
The girl looked indignant.
"Do you not have amazing wizardly powers?"
"Oh, yes, certainly, but,
"Say something in wizard language."
"Stercus, stercus, stercus moritatus sum," said Rincewind, his eye on the knife.
"Oh, excrement. Am I about to die?"
"It's, a special mantra I say to raise the magical fluxes."
The girl subsided a little.
"But it takes it out of you, wizarding," said Rincewind. "Flying on dragons, magically turning old men into warriors. I can only do so much of that sort of thing before it's time for a rest. Right now I'm very weak on account of the tremendous amounts of magic I've just used, you see."
She looked at him with doubt still in her eyes.
"All the peasants believe in the imminent arrival of the great wizard," she said. "But in the words of the great philosopher Li Tin Weedle, when many expect a mighty stallion, they will find hooves on an ant."
She gave him another calculating look.
"When you were on the road," she said, "you grovelled in front of District Commissioner Key. You could have blasted him with terrible fire."
"Biding my time. Spying out the land, not wanting to break my cover," Rincewind gabbled. "No good revealing myself straight away, is there?"
"You are maintaining a disguise?"
"Yes."
"It is a very good one."
"Thank you, because..."
"Only a great wizard could dare to look like such a pathetic piece of humanity."
"Thank you. How did you know I was on the road?"
"They would have killed you there and then if I had not told you what to do."
"You were the guard?"
"We had to catch up with you quickly. It was sheer luck you were seen by Four Big Sandal."
"We?"
She ignored the question.
They are only provincial soldiers. I would not have got away with it in Hong Kong. But I can play many roles.
She put away the knife, but Rincewind had a feeling that he hadn't talked her into believing him, only into not killing him. He groped for a straw. I've got a magic box on legs, he said, with a touch of pride. It follows me around. It seems to have got itself mislaid right now, but it's quite an amazing thing. The girl gave him a wooden look. Then she reached down with a delicate hand and hauled him upright.
Is it, she said, something like this?
She twitched aside the curtains at the rear of the cart. Two boxes were trundling along in the dust. They were more battered and cheaper looking than the luggage, but recognisably the same general species, if you could apply the word to travel accessories. Yes. She let go. Rincewind's head hit the floor.
Listen to me, she said. A lot of bad things are happening. I don't believe in great wizards, but other people do, and sometimes people need something to believe in. And if these other people die because we've got a wizard who is not so very great, then he will be a very unlucky wizard indeed. You may be the great wizard. If you are not, then I suggest you study very hard to be great. Do I make myself clear?
Yes. Rincewind had been faced with death on numerous occasions. Often there was armour and swords involved. This occasion just involved a pretty girl and a knife, but somehow managed to be among the worst. She sat back.
We are a travelling theatre, she said. It is convenient. No actors are allowed to move around.
Aren't they? Said Rincewind.
You do not understand. We are no actors.
Oh, you weren't too bad.
Great wizard, no is a non-realist, symbolic form of theatre employing archaic language, stylized gestures, and an accompaniment of flutes and drums. Your pretense of stupidity is masterly, so much so that I could even believe that you are no actor.
Excuse me, what is your name? Rincewind said.
Pretty Butterfly.
Yes? She glared at him and slipped away towards the front of the cart. It rumbled on. Rincewind lay with his head in a sack smelling of onions and methodically cursed things. He cursed women with knives, and history generally, and the entire faculty of Unseen University, and his absent luggage, and the population of the Agatean Empire. But right now, at the top of the list, was whoever had designed this cart. By the feel of it, whoever had thought that rough, splintery wood was the right surface for a floor was also the person who thought triangular was a nice shape for a wheel. The luggage lurked in a ditch, watched without much interest by a man holding a water buffalo on the end of a piece of string. It was feeling ashamed and baffled and lost. It was lost because everywhere around it was familiar. The light, the smells, the feel of the soil. But it didn't feel owned. It was made of wood. Wood is sensitive to these things. One of its many feet idly traced an outline in the mud. It was a random, wretched pattern, familiar to anyone who's had to stand in front of the class and be scolded. Finally, it reached something that was probably as close as timber can get to a decision. It had been given away. It had spent many years trailing through strange lands, meeting exotic creatures and jumping up and down on them. Now it was back in the country where it had once been a tree. Therefore, it was free. It was not the most logical chain of thought, but pretty good when all you've got to think with are knot holes. And there was something it very much wanted to do.
When you're ready, teach.
Sorry, Genghis, I'm just finishing.
Cohen sighed. The horde were taking advantage of the rest to sit in the shade of a tree and tell one another lies about their exploits, while Mr. Savaloy stood on top of a boulder, squinting through some kind of homemade device and doodling on his maps. Bits of paper ruled the world now, Cohen told himself. It certainly ruled this part of it. And Teach, well, Teach ruled bits of paper. He might not be traditional barbarian hero material, despite his deeply held belief that all headmasters should be riveted to a cowshed door, but the man was amazing with bits of paper. And he could speak Agatean. Well, speak it better than Cohen, who'd picked it up in a rough and ready way. He said he'd learnt it out of some old book. He said it was amazing how much interesting stuff was in old books. Cohen struggled up alongside him.
What exactly are you planning, Teach?
He said. Mr. Savaloy squinted at Hung Hung, just visible on the dusty horizon.
"Do you see that hill behind the city?" he said. "The huge round mound?"
"Looks like my dad's burial mound to me," said Cohen.
"No, it must be a natural formation. It's far too big. There's some kind of pagoda on top, I see. Interesting. Perhaps later I shall take a closer look."
Cohen peered at the big round hill. It was a big round hill. It wasn't threatening him, and it didn't look valuable. End of saga, as far as he was concerned. There were more pressing matters.
"People appear to be entering and leaving the outer city," Mr. Savaloy continued. "The siege is more a threat than a reality, so getting inside should not be a problem. Of course, getting into the forbidden city itself will be a lot more difficult."
"How about if we kill everyone?" said Cohen.
"A good idea, but impractical," said Mr. Savaloy, "and liable to cause comment. No, my current methodology is predicated on the fact that Hung Hung is some considerable way from the river, yet has almost 1 million inhabitants."
"Predicated, yeah," said Cohen.
"And the local geography is quite wrong for artesian wells."
"Yeah, that's what I thought."
"And yet there is no visible aqueduct, you notice."
"No aqueduct, right," said Cohen. "Probably flown to the rim for the summer. Some birds do that."
"Which rather leads me to doubt the saying that not even a mouse can get into the Forbidden City," said Mr. Savaloy, with just a trace of smugness. "I suspect a mouse could get into the Forbidden City if it could hold its breath."
"Or ride on one of them invisible ducks," said Cohen.
"Indeed."
The cart stopped. The sack came off. Instead of the cheese grater Rincewind was secretly expecting, the view consisted of a couple of young, concerned faces. One of them was female, but Rincewind was relieved to see that she wasn't Pretty Butterfly. This one looked younger, and made Rincewind think a little of potatoes.
"When you're on a desert island, your appetites can become a bit confused."
"How you are?"
she said in a fractured but recognisable Morporkian.
"We are very sorry. All better now? We speak you in language of celestial city of Ankh-Morpork. Language of freedom and progress. Language of one man, one vote."
"Yes," said Rincewind. A vision of Ankh-Morpork's patrician floated across his memory. One man, one vote. "Yes. I've met him. He's definitely got the vote. But..."
"Extra luck to the people's endeavour," said the boy. "Advance judiciously."
He looked as though he'd been built with bricks.
"Excuse me," said Rincewind, "but why did you...
a paper lantern for ceremonial purposes. Bale of cotton. Rescue me. That is, when I say rescue, I suppose I mean, why did you hit me on the head, tie me up and bring me to wherever this is? Because the worst that could have happened to me in the inn was a ding round the ear for not paying for lunch."
"The worst that would have happened was an agonising death over several years," said the voice of Butterfly.
She appeared round the cart and smiled grimly at Rincewind. Her hands were tucked demurely in her kimono, presumably to hide the knives. "Oh, hello," he said.
"Great wizard," said Butterfly, bowing. "I you already know, but these two are Lotus Blossom and Three Yoked Oxen, other members of our cadre. We had to bring you here like this. There are spies everywhere."
"Timely demise to all enemies," said the boy, beaming.
"Good, yes, right," said Rincewind. "All enemies, yes."
The cart was in a courtyard. The general noise level on the other side of the very high walls suggested a large city. Nasty, certainly crystallised.
"And you've brought me to Hung Hung, haven't you?" he said.
Lotus Blossom's eyes widened.
"Then it are true," she said, in Rincewind's own language. "You are the great wizard."
"Oh, you'd be amazed at the things I can foresee," said Rincewind, despondently.
"You two, go and stable the horses," said Butterfly, not taking her eyes off Rincewind.
When they'd hurried away with several backward glances, she walked up to him.
"They believe," she said. "Personally, I have my doubts.
But Lee Tin Weedle says an ass may do the work of an ox in time of no horses. One of his less convincing aphorisms, I always thought.
Thank you. What is a cadre?
Have you heard of the Red Army?
No. Well, I heard someone shout something.
According to legend, an unknown person known only as the Great Wizard led the first Red Army to an impossible victory. Of course, that was thousands of years ago, but the people believe that he, that is, you, will return to do it again. So there should be a Red Army ready and waiting.
Well, of course, a man can get a little stiff after several thousand years. Her face was suddenly level with his own.
Personally, I suspect there has been a misunderstanding, she hissed. But now you're here, you'll be a great wizard, if I have to prod you every step of the way.
The other two returned. Butterfly went from snarling tiger to demure doe in an instant.
And now you must come and meet the Red Army, she said.
Won't they be a little smelly? Rincewind began, and stopped when he saw her expression.
The original Red Army was clearly only a legend, she said, in fast and faultless Ankh-Morpokian. But legends have their uses. You'd better know the legend, great wizard. When one son Mira was fighting all the armies of the world, the great wizard came to his aid, and the earth itself rose up and fought for the new empire. And lightning was involved. The army was made from the earth, but in some way driven by the lightning. Now, lightning may kill, but I suspect it lacks discipline, and earth cannot fight. But no doubt our army of the earth and sky was nothing more nor less than an uprising of the peasants themselves. Well, now we have a new army, and a name that fires the imagination, and a great wizard. I don't believe in legends, but I believe that other people believe.
The younger girl, who had been trying to follow this, stepped forward and gripped his arm.
You're coming seeing Red Army now, she said. Forward motion with masses, said the boy, taking Rincewind's other arm.
Does he always talk like that? Said Rincewind, as he was propelled gently towards the door.
Three yoked oxen does not study, said the girl. Extra success, attend our leaders.
Tuppence a bucket well stamped down, said Rincewind encouragingly.
Much ownership of means of production.
How's your granny off for soap? Three yoked oxen beamed.
Butterfly opened the door. That left Rincewind outside with the other two.
Very useful slogans, he said, moving sideways just a little. But I would draw your attention to the famous saying of the great wizard Rincewind.
Indeed, I am all ear, said Lotus Blossom politely.
Rincewind, he say, goodbye! His sandals skidded on the cobbles, but he was already travelling fast when he hit the doors, which turned out to be made of bamboo and smashed apart easily. There was a street market on the other side. That was something Rincewind remembered later about Hung Hung. As soon as there was a space, any kind of space, even a space created by the passage of a cart or a mule, people flowed into it, usually arguing with one another at the tops of their voices over the price of a duck which was being held upside down and quacking. His foot went through a wicker cage containing several chickens, but he pressed on, scattering people and produce. In an Ankh-Morpork street market, something like this would have caused some comment. But since everyone around him already seemed to be screaming into other people's faces, Rincewind was merely a momentary and unremarked nuisance as he half ran, half limped with one squawking foot past the stalls. Behind him, the people flowed back. There may have been some cries of pursuit, but they were lost in the hubbub. He didn't stop until he found an overlooked alcove between a stall selling songbirds and another purveying something that bubbled in bowls. His foot crowed. He smashed it against cobbles until the cage broke. The cockerel, maddened by the heady air of freedom, pecked him on the knee and fluttered away. There were no sounds of pursuit. However, a battalion of trolls in tin boots would have had trouble making themselves heard above a normal Hung Hung street market. He let himself get his breath back. Well, he was his own man again. So much for the Red Army. Admittedly, he was in the capital city, where he didn't want to be, and it was only a matter of time before something else unpleasant happened to him, but it wasn't actually happening at the moment. Let him find his bearings and 5 minutes' start, and they could watch his dust, or mud. And there was a lot of both here. So, this was Hung Hung.
There didn't seem to be streets in the sense Rincewind understood the term. Alleys opened onto alleys, all of them narrow and made narrower by the stalls that lined them. There was a large animal population in the marketplace. Most of the stalls had their share of caged chickens, ducks in sacks, and strange wriggling things in bowls. From one stall, a tortoise on top of a struggling heap of other tortoises under a sign saying, 3 R each, good for ying, gave Rincewind a slow, you think you've got troubles, look. But it was hard to tell where the stalls ended and the buildings began, in any case. Dried up things hanging on a string might be merchandise or someone's washing or quite possibly next week's dinner.